You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hi, this is Jason Gay from an undisclosed location. Coming up, part two of our conversation with Wall Street Journal basketball writer Chris Herring, the free-for-all.
You're listening to Free-for-All from the Wall Street Journal. Now, here's Jason Gay.
We're here with Chris Herring, basketball writer extraordinaire at the Wall Street Journal. Chris, if I give you a wad of cash and say, you can go buy some tickets, go to games, you don't have to write about anything, this is just you, bring a friend, bring a date. Who's a player, who's a team you want to see? Now, we all know Golden State. But who? Give me a couple others.
That's a good question. I don't think about that much.
You're like, I want to do anything but go to a basketball game.
I'm probably not gonna. So I'm gonna. I'll make good use of my press pass. I'm not gonna use it to go watch the Knicks. At least not right now. You know, for the money, and again, when you think about where, I'm always someone that kind of thinks, how can I get my best money's worth out of something?
Yeah.
Oklahoma City is so much fun. Yeah. Westbrook, and I know your relationship with Russ. I've said, you know, even with Steph playing the way he plays, I still think Russ is probably the most interesting player to watch because he's just – he in an era where you see guys taking games to rest and, you know, to, in some cases play more conservatively and to make sure that their bodies are going to hold up. Russ has had multiple surgeries on his legs, and I mean, it doesn't seem that way. It's like he seems like a souped-up, like, you know, car, and he's so much fun to watch. And some of it is reckless, but it's so entertaining to me. And you factor that in, and a team that has two of the maybe three, four, five best players in the league on one team, might not be good enough to win a title with the kind of team that Golden State is, and even the Spurs are, but. I love watching Oklahoma City, and you could probably go to a couple games down there. It's not as expensive in the heartland of the country as it is in New York
or
on the Bay.
What's another example? I mean, maybe an up-and-comer team that you're like, you know, that's a fun watch.
When I went to – I mean, I was in Minneapolis the other day to go watch the Knicks play there. The Knicks won that game, and it was, I think, one of their three wins in the last 18 games they've had, but – you know, Karl Anthony Towns is going to be so good between him and then you factor in, you know, they had Andrew Wiggins who won Rookie of the Year last year and they've also got all these other guys, you know, Zach LaVine who just won the dunk contest and obviously a dunk contest doesn't mean you're going to be a good player, but they've just got so much athleticism on that team. They're looking to go younger. They've got Garnett kind of working as a mentor to these guys. Who knows whether they'll turn out to be good, but you know Towns will be really good if he stays healthy for the remainder of his career. And
what
so,
about Ricky? What's the story?
Ricky Rubio, I mean, it sounds like they were kind of taking offers for him. They obviously didn't move him, but, I mean, they have all the pieces on that team to at some point be good. Who knows how long it will take?
Yeah.
But, I mean, they probably need a coach. I love Sam Mitchell to death in terms of talking with him. Even in a piece I wrote today, he gave me such a fun quote and it's such a fun interview. But, you know, they have the makings of something that could be really entertaining and really, really good a couple years from now.
Yeah, I'm going to sound like a homer from my home state, but I was up in Boston last night and I went to the Blazers-Celtics
game. That's a fun
team. And the Celtics are fun, and the Blazers are really
fun.
They had a bad night. There was a back-to-back. I mean, the Blazers are really fun to watch, but the Celtics...
Those are the two hottest teams in the league really right now.
They just run. They run, they run, they run, they run, they run. And they cut, and they... I mean, listen, they're not full of – they do not have a superstar. I mean, Isaiah is having a very good year.
There's no such thing as a 5'9 superstar.
Right.
You can't have one.
Yeah. But they – I mean, it was – listen, I've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly in that arena, and it was a wildly entertaining night of basketball.
Those two teams that you just mentioned, I mean, you could make a great argument for them. You were saying up-and-comer, so those teams – I mean, Portland, I guess – They just played the Knicks the other night, so I got to see them up close. That probably end up winning Executive of the Year for Neil Olshey.
Sure. This was supposed to be a year off.
They lost four starters and basically replaced them with either guys that were already on the team that were younger or very cheap talent, and you know are in the thick of the playoff race. They're going to make the playoffs most likely. then Boston, all of a sudden, I mean, they're fighting for probably the two or the three seed in the East, and they've got a top five defense. They've got a guy that, while he hasn't proven himself the way that Rick Carlisle or Greg Popovich has, is probably a top five or top six coach in Brad Stevens.
Yeah.
And so no stars, but just guys that night in, night out give you consistent effort, play solid defense, and play both sides of the floor.
And I sort of hate all these cliches that they use, but they just kind of like bought in. Like everybody on that team seems like they're on the same page. There's not a guy like sort of wandering around who doesn't, you know.
This is last year's version of Atlanta, I think, where Atlanta won 60 games last year just by being solid and having guys that weren't a huge liability on either end of the floor.
Yeah.
That's what Boston is this year with probably a better coach.
Even in the time that you've been on the beat, do you see an evolution happening in the game with regards to, you know, we think, of course, of the lights out type of shooting that we're seeing in some teams, but also just the ball distribution, the spreading of the floor, the spacing. Do you see that? You know, you're sort of watching over a pretty interesting transformation in basketball right
now. Yeah, and I mean, the thing that is really interesting to me is that teams just bludgeon you now if you can't defend those aspects of the game. If you can't defend a basic pick and roll or a high pick and roll, you literally have no chance against a team like Golden State because that's what they're going to run the majority of the time, and then they throw in other elements here and there. But, you know, watching the Knicks, of all teams, of course, defensively, they've gone years now without being able to guard that play.
Right.
And just watching the Spurs and Golden State and those types of teams literally line up three and four pick and rolls in a row to say, okay, if you stopped us this time, we're pretty sure you won't stop us the next time.
Yeah.
And it's just the sort of thing where you can't you have a much better chance of stopping someone if you're all aligned in the same 4, 5, 6 foot space.
Yeah.
But when you open that up to the whole court and you've got guys sprinting around screens and picks and everything like that, off curls, you have no chance to guard that if you're slow-footed. And that, again, that's why a team like Boston's actually pretty good, because they have a bunch of guys that can run around and chase guys like that. The Knicks don't, but it's difficult to defend. And, that's why you see teams about to, you know, you have two teams potentially that could win 70 games. I mean, people focus on Golden State, as they should, but the Spurs,
on a record rate,
the Spurs run a lot of the same sorts of concepts, and I mean, they have a bunch of older guys running the same sorts of plays, but almost just as successful. And you've got Oklahoma City that's right behind them in terms of the offense.
Now, I have the luxury, because I'm a lazy person, of just skimming the cream right off the top and watching the Spurs and watching OKC and watching the Warriors and so on. And yet what I hear from people in your business a lot is that, you know, once you get beyond that, you know, amazing top quarter of the league, there's just a lot of ugly basketball out there, and especially that bottom half of the league. I don't want to say that there's some sort of, you know, crisis, but Adam Silver's talked a lot about quality of game. You know, that's an urgent issue for them, is to make sure that your average NBA event, you know, it's a pretty penny now to buy a ticket to an NBA game, is an entertaining experience. Do you think that there's still a great deal of work to be done in terms of making the average game entertaining enough to merit the price?
Yeah. What I struggle with is to figure out how the league does something about that specifically without changing the lottery process.
But I mean, they're doing in-game things in, i.e., like, you know, I think, you know, eliminating hand-checking and so on was definitely a move towards the idea of, you know, making the game more fun to watch, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, that aspect of, I think, the in-game stuff, and now they're starting, it sounds like they're finally going to address the hack-a-shack type stuff, which they need to, because, you know, games end up being 30 minutes longer than they need to be, and no one wants to watch a game that's stilted like that. But
I think they just put DeAndre and, like, the five other people in the league who can't shoot free throws at a high percentage, they send them to camp. It's like detention. It's like, you know, it's like free throw island for as long as it takes for them to come back and just shoot just 50%. I'm not asking a lot. I mean, because it's a weird thing to be pressing into to legislate some rule change on the basis of, we're really talking about what? A half dozen guys and then maybe three in terms of playoff?
It is fascinating. I actually was tweeting with someone about this the other day. Hassan Whiteside from Miami, who was another one of these guys on that list, all of a sudden, he was like sub 50% for the whole season, and all of a sudden has made like 23 out of his last 24.
Yeah.
And it's a weird thing. Like, people feel so strongly about that, that you either are who you are, and even if you try, you're not going to get better at free throws. And then other people are like, why don't they just work on free throws? I can't speak to it personally. I mean, it's a different level of pressure to practice it. And I've seen guys who aren't even good free throw shooters step back and make 10 threes in a row just in warm-ups, because these guys are pros.
Well, I always think that when I go to an NBA game and you're on the court watching beforehand, you're watching guys warm up, they really rarely miss. Yeah. The guys that you think are bums, the guys who think you dread getting a ball, they can shoot the hell out of the basketball. Yeah. They will sink 20-footer after 20-footer after 20-footer. But the difference, of course, is how you do it with something on the line and with a hand in your face.
With the lights on.
And with the lights on, exactly.
It's an interesting thing. But I do think there are things that the league can tweak with regards to that. But I don't know how much of it speaks to the tanking issue, which is, I think, what you were asking about. Because the Lakers, the Lakers kind of put themselves in the spot by re-signing Kobe at that money, because they would have had a lot more flexibility if you don't have a 37-year-old who's making $25 million a year. But then you've got a team like Philly that at least seemed relatively content with the idea of losing as long as it takes to get their bona fide star. They still have yet to win a top pick since they've gone on this track.
Yeah.
And I feel like they're probably going to keep trying to do this until they get that top pick.
There does seem to be this like sort of middle belt of teams that, you know, are inconsistent but are at least kind of fun to watch. Okay, like, so I put, you know, Celtics, the Blazers, the Jazz, maybe a little bit Orlando, Milwaukee, although Milwaukee's not had the kind of year that I think people expected them to.
How do you
make
feel about late. Sacramento?
Sacramento, you know, I mean, craziness. Rondo has, like, you know, made them a very quirky but interesting team to watch. Atlanta, you know, has slipped a little bit. I mean, there's this, you know, again, this sort of belt in the middle of teams that are not terrible tickets by any stretch. I thought the Knicks were one of them for the first few months of the season.
They were 22-22. They were right in the middle.
Yeah, and they were going to be a team that might not necessarily be playoff quality, but I wouldn't have been shocked. If you had said to me January 1st, the Knicks are going to get the eighth slot, I would have been like, huh, good for them.
They were a half game out, I think, as of January 22nd. So it's only been a month and a half, and all of a sudden they're at risk now of finishing in the bottom two or three spots in the East, which is exactly where they were last year.
What has happened?
A lot, obviously. I mean, they fired Derek Fisher when they were in the midst of
he a secret genius that we did not know?
I will say this, because I felt crazy. Like, it's probably the most out of the loop I've felt since I've been on the beat, where this is how out of the loop I was on this one, even though I talked to people within the organization, obviously. Someone emailed me the night before Fisher was fired.
Okay.
After the Knicks lost, and said, "Do you feel like any point soon that people start making decisions or start, you know, maybe we start thinking that Fisher may not survive this?" And I said, "No, I don't think we're at that point."
Right.
And actually, if I'm being honest, this is someone I email with a decent amount. I just said no. I didn't even explain. Yeah. I just said no, and that was my email. And
the
then so
day.
I got a really nice told you so email the next morning. But
the presumption was, when it happened, that you make a move like this, it's atypical for a team that is sort of in the place that the Knicks were doing.
Right.
They were overachieving, basically, from what early season expectations were. You make that move because you got something cooking. Like, somebody's out there, something's out there. You know, you don't just go to the next guy on the bench.
Yeah, I didn't like the move. I mean, I was one of the few people. I had just written a piece maybe a month before all that, maybe a little bit further before that, saying that Derek Fisher, for the first time, is really starting to show some promise and some progress, where the first year you really didn't know what to make of him because the roster, they stripped it down so far.
Yeah.
And then the second year, you know, this is a 500 team. And by the way, if you pay really close attention, Derek Fisher seems to have figured out the rotation and a way to keep Porzingis and Robin Lopez in the game, and then to switch one of them out and kind of replace one with the other to keep one on the floor all the time. And all of a sudden you look at the numbers and you start looking at how they're scoring and how efficient they are out of timeouts, which is normally a pretty decent indicator of how a coach is doing, or at least their creativity and stuff like that. And all these numbers are starting to really shoot up and starting to trend in the right direction. And then they do hit a rough patch. Part of it is Carmelo being injured. He tripped over a referee, of all things. Yeah. They lose their best defender on the wing and Lance Thomas, and they go on a slide. And so, you know, and they start losing some really close games at the end where Derek Fisher either doesn't get them a good shot or doesn't even elect to call a
timeout. Games that they had been winning.
They had been winning some of these games. And so there were a couple instances where they get relatively good shots, but Derek Fisher doesn't call timeout to set them up. He said, well, we wanted to just, the defense wasn't set, so we wanted to just let the play go on without me interjecting. And then, you know, and then he gets fired. And the thing that happened, I think there were a couple concerns. One was that the team was starting to really get blasted to start these games, where they didn't look focused to come out. Right. And
like a Jets game.
Oh, every Jets game. But that happened, and then you did start to hear players starting to get frustrated, and there was a lot of this flimsiness in terms of, like, certain guys playing and then not ever playing and in and out of the rotation. And Derek Fisher really didn't seem to have an answer for most of it. He had just made a comment about how the playoffs weren't the team's sole focus, that the process was more important than whether or not they made the playoffs. And so there were some weird things that had happened, and then there was all the off-court stuff that had happened before the season. But I had just said in my story that I thought Derek Fisher was making progress. And like you said, the expectation was not for the team to make the playoffs this year for most people.
Yeah.
I think maybe they lifted the expectations early on with how well they played against a lot of playoff competition. But I don't think you can fire somebody for being 9 games under 500, you know, when they weren't expected to be much better than that. They were on pace for about 35 wins, which would have doubled what they had.
Sure.
And I don't know. I was confused.
Do you think there's a plan? Do you think that there's a guy or a woman in mind to coach this team?
In my mind, sure. In Phil's, you know, I really don't understand why you let go of someone like Fisher when he's young and he's at least showing some positive signs.
You're paying him $5 million. $5 million a year.
I guess it's not Phil's $5 million, but yeah. I mean, that's what told you that it clearly was something bigger than just the wins and losses. Phil referenced a whole bunch of communication things that he was concerned about, and you know, maybe some of the off court stuff did factor into the decision. But to me, I can't fathom a situation other than the one the Knicks have with Phil, where you don't even really consider someone like Tom Thibodeau.
Yeah.
Probably the best coach in the game who's not in the game at this moment.
Right.
You know, had the
and
best.
And if reports are to be believed, has, you know, MSG among his dream job list.
I've talked to people that said that this guy was actually in New York the day that Fisher was fired, saw the news, and was like thinking to himself, should I stay here? I would walk there right now. Does it make sense to fly all the way back to Chicago when I'm already here? To let them know that I want the job. But the thing is, I think he's at a point where he has enough power, or should have enough power, to where he can kind of call his shot.
But isn't it also true that, you know, and I know you have, you know, you're a professional, but to cover the Knicks, what you need to do, or to just follow the Knicks, what you need to do is just treat the idea of logic as a
foreign object,
a flaming trash barrel that you throw out the window immediately.
Well, yeah, because I mean, the thing is, the only reason that I wasn't really heavily critical of the decision to fire Fisher was, like you said, if you need time to really figure out who you want to replace him, it's not college football where you fire someone and if you do it early, you can start recruiting guys for that job in December. You could fire someone the last day of the season and still get someone good because no one's going to replace someone midseason normally.
Yeah.
But, I mean, in this situation,
you've run the risk of another team swooping in and making the move that you want. Yeah.
Right. So I understood it. But if you're not going to consider these guys that are so highly touted, Thibodeau, you know, obviously Luke Walton will probably get a real good look because he's got ties to Phil. But the problem with the whole situation and my confidence in Phil at this point is he going to take a real, honest, concerted effort to look at guys that he doesn't necessarily have ties to? Because Thibodeau is one of the best in the game. The Knicks, I've written this several times, if you look at from the year when Van Gundy stopped coaching the team to now, they've had the worst defense in the league combined, you know, for all those 13, 14 years or whatever.
Yeah.
So they've been consistently bad. They've only had 2 years where they weren't in the bottom 10 defensively. Yeah. And yet we keep talking about the triangle as if the triangle and the offense is their only problem. When you have Carmelo and Kristaps Porzingis, your offense is probably going to be at least okay, maybe slightly below average, but the defense is a huge issue, and Thibodeau brings that.
I want to stop right there and come back with Chris. We'll be back. This is the Free For All.
That was part two of our conversation with basketball writer extraordinaire Chris Herring. Join us for part three on the Free For All.